Geopolitics refers to the study of how geographic factors interact with political power and strategy. And the main geographical focus in geopolitics has always been the Eurasian continent. This is the vast continent spanning from the Atlantic to the Pacific and from the Arctic to the Arabian Sea. So this is the continent with most of the world's people, most of the world's resources, and also most of the world's territory. And the general idea has always been, if you control Eurasia, you can control the world. And I will discuss here a brief history of how the great powers have competed, largely around the efforts to control Eurasia. And I will finish with the radical shift in power that we're currently seeing, which is currently transforming the entire world order. So, as we know, Eurasia was historically connected by the ancient Silk Road, with land corridors as well as maritime corridors, used for the exchange of culture, ideas, technology, as well as material goods. The ancient Silk Road was decentralized. It consisted of many paths connecting the different civilizations, with trade routes usually being managed by nomads. And the nomadic Mongol Empire became the last empire that had a key role in expanding and maintaining the ancient Silk Road. But this began its collapse in the 14th century. Primarily the maritime corridors were replaced by the rise of European maritime powers in the beginning of the 16th century. Columbus, Magellan, Da Gama, they all unleashed a revolution of geography as they connected the world by sea. And this had several implications as new power structures were forming. Unlike the ancient Silk Road, the maritime corridors of the European powers became very centralized and also European-led. The focus was on controlling key ports, maritime choke points, in which one power can monopolize on control. And there are a few options in terms of diversification. Now, the impulse for dominance was further increased by technological innovations in Europe, which is why, for example, Adam Smith recognized that Europe's encounter with the rest of the world developed in a very destructive and exploitative format. Adam Smith hoped that in the future that there would be less power inequality, that is, less concentration of power in the Europeans, to ensure that economic relations were more mutually beneficial, as this concentration of power in Europe created a very dominant position and also, therefore, extractive and subordinated role for their territories, which Europeans came in contact with. The system of dominance of maritime powers was constructed. We saw that the trade post empires were maritime powers, they were commercial empires in which control over ports and shipping routes were important for strategic dominance over global trade. And this was more important than territorial conquest. However, over time, the European trade post empires developed into full-fledged empires. And the European empires would then compete indirectly by conquering the rest of the world. But at the end, also then getting conflict with each other. And over time, one after another, great power began to diminish. And the dominant maritime power would then become a global hegemon. And we saw this at the beginning of the 19th century, after a long rivalry between the French and the British. The defeat of Napoleon became the starting point of Pax Britannica, that is a peace under a dominant Britain, which is considered to have lasted for 100 years until the First World War. That is, the British dominated the sea, and by controlling the sea, what connects the world, this was the source of the British hegemon, which was later replaced by the United States, as the US ceased to then control over these corridors instead. Now, furthermore, the British, especially from the beginning of the 19th century, also had a huge head start in the Industrial Revolution and also the financial power, which then led to further augmenting the power of the British. But at this point, after there was one British hegemon, we also saw that the geopolitics of Eurasia had changed, because during the Napoleonic War, something else very important had happened. Very briefly, Russia had aligned itself with Napoleon and had sent a Cossack expedition between 1800 and 1801 through Central Asia to reach British India. And it was feared that this could threaten British control over British India. And a new geopolitical reality thus emerged, that is, British control over the seas was not enough to control the Eurasian continent, because a major Eurasian land power like Russia could then begin to connect the Eurasian continent by land. From there on, over the next 70 years, the British-Russian rivalry became known as the Great Game, a 19th century geopolitical rivalry for control over Central Eurasia, considered to have lasted between 1820 to 1890. Now, this was a competition to control trade routes, resources, and in the years to come, we saw that first the Russians won the war against Persia in 1828, which threatened to control parts of the southern maritime periphery as the Russians expanded towards the coast. And Britain was obviously no longer the dominant state. They couldn't push back the Russians, and Persia was under great pressure to align with Russia, and collectively they could therefore even move against British India. Now, at the same time, the British and the French were worried that Russia was moving ever closer toward the Ottoman Empire. This is when the British and French attacked Russia in the Crimean War, lasting between 1853 and 56, with the purpose of pushing Russia out of Europe altogether. Now, the Russians suffered a humiliating defeat. The reasons can be summarized as not having any real significant industries that could be converted to serve the war efforts. Furthermore, the Russians had very poor infrastructure, and it was evident that the Russians had fallen far behind on industrialization. And the Russians responded with what's referred to as the Great Reforms. Rapid industrializations, also building railroads through Central Asia. And these railroads, interestingly enough, followed much of the same path as the ancient Silk Road, reaching all the way to Afghanistan. And after many wars, the Great Game eventually ended with the Pamir Boundary Commission protocols of 1895, which made Afghanistan a buffer state between the Russian Empire and the British Empire. This is, again, the reason for the very strange geography of Afghanistan's eastern regions. And with this buffer, British maritime dominance seemingly could continue. However, in the 1890s, Russia also built a Trans-Siberian Railway connecting Moscow with Vladivostok on the Pacific coast. This yet again challenged British control over East Asia, that is the eastern edge of the Eurasian continent. So with all of this, a geopolitical theory of Eurasia was born in Britain. It was called the Heartland Theory, developed by Halford Mackinder in the early 20th century, first articulated in 1904 in an article called The Geographical Pivot of History. In this article, Mackinder wrote, and this is a quote, "Who rules East Europe commands the Heartland. Who rules the Heartland commands the World Island. Who rules the World Island commands the world." So, in short, Eastern Europe was the central area to control in order to dominate the world. Mackinder argued that the world is divided into two naturally antagonistic spheres, land and sea. The maritime hegemon, being Britain at the time, was therefore in threat of losing its competitive advantage if Eurasia would be dominated by land instead. Mackinder noted that railways had traditionally only supported maritime-based commerce. That is, the railroads would just cut the shortest possible road to the coastline, and thereafter it would be boarded on the shipping. But with transcontinental railways across the Eurasian continent, new transportation corridors could be established that would instead replace maritime transportation and thus end the dominance of maritime powers altogether. In the words of Mackinder, he wrote, "A generation ago, and the Suez Canal appeared to have increased the mobility of sea power relative to land power. Railways acted chiefly as feeders to ocean-going commerce, but transcontinental railways are now transmuting the conditions of land power, and nowhere can they have such effect as in the closed heartland of Eurasia, in the vast areas of which neither timber nor accessible stone was available for road making." End quote. So Mackinder also noted that the Russian army having a presence in Manchuria was all the evidence required that mobile land powers were now becoming as competitive as evidence of maritime powers being competitive with the presence of the British army in South Africa. So they now had a key rivalry between the leading maritime power and the leading land power. Now, this created an entirely new reality, given that there was no longer a competition between maritime powers to control the world. Instead, you had Eurasian land powers, which could then completely overturn the significance of controlling the seas altogether. And the greatest challenge or threat of the British was therefore who could connect the Eurasian landmass. And the key threat then, back in the 19th century, was obviously a German-Russian alliance that could connect this continent. And it's really hard to overstate how important these ideas have been for geopolitics, not only shaping British strategy, but also American strategy once America became the dominant state. Indeed, we see in US National Security Council reports all the way back from 1948 and onwards, it referred to the Eurasian containment policies in the language of Mackinder and his Heartland Theory. So, for example, on the very first page of the US National Security Strategy of 1988, Mackinder, sorry, the security strategy reads, quote, "The United States' most basic national security interests would be endangered if a hostile state or group of states were to dominate the Eurasian landmass, that area of the globe often referred to as the world's heartland. We fought two world wars to prevent this from occurring." Thereafter, it also goes on explaining this is why they confronted the Soviet Union. The US, as the leading maritime power, could not allow a Eurasian power from connecting by land. Now, America's containment strategy entailed dominating Eurasia from its coast, that is, a maritime periphery. So Europe would be the western edge of Eurasia, and on the eastern periphery, they had island states off the coast of China from Japan and onwards, which the US had conceptually defined in its dual island chain containment strategy immediately after World War II. Now, if we go back to the Russians, they also built on the ideas of Mackinder in the beginning of the 20th century. That is, after Tsarist Russia was swept away by the Bolshevik Revolution and replaced with the Soviet Union, you then had Eurasianists in Russia going in exile. People like Savitsky, who outlined ideas in the 1920s, of what should actually replace the Soviet Union after it would eventually fail. Now, people like Savitsky warned that the First World War had largely been caused by maritime powers, compelling Germany to expand eastward to gain strategic space. And looking at the other side of this coin, a Russian-German alliance would therefore be ideal to balance the hegemonic impulses of the maritime empires. And given that the Germans didn't have a proper empire, maritime empire of their own, it would then be seen as being more inclined to align itself with land power. Now, the maritime powers were seen as being natural imperialistic or naturally destructive, as their dominance from the periphery would depend on divide and rule strategies. That is, they had to prevent the major powers in Eurasia from connecting. That is, China, Russia, Germany, Turkey, they all have to remain divided in order for the maritime powers to dominate from the sea. So the Eurasian response to Western maritime powers, the imperial powers, was therefore seen by people like Savitsky to be seeking cooperation across Eurasia. And furthermore, the great curse of Russia had been that it was a Eurasian power. However, it had attempted ever since Peter the Great's time to develop and position itself as a Western European maritime power. And the best way the British, Americans, and anyone else could contain the Russians was simply to cut off its access to maritime corridors, a strategy which still works in terms of limiting Russia's access to the Black Sea, to the Baltic Sea, and the Arctic. Then, of course, Russia would be pushed into Asia. This was the logic. Well, after the Cold War and thereafter, the collapse of the Soviet Union, we see that Russia did not go back to this Eurasian vision of people like Savitsky. Instead, Russia returned to the very Western-centric policies, largely ignoring even the countries in the East as they pursued this goal of greater Europe instead. That is an inclusive European security architecture. However, the strategy of the Russians ignored that Russia was weakened, and the US saw an historical opportunity to create a permanent hegemonic system in Europe, and by dominating Eurasia as well from the periphery. Indeed, less than 2 months after the Soviet Union collapsed, we saw that the Wolfowitz doctrine was outlined in a leaked draft of the Defense Planning Guidance of 1992, and it outlined the following, and this is a quote: "It is improbable that a global conventional challenge to US and Western security will re-emerge from the Eurasian heartland for many years to come." End quote. However, the main objective was to prevent one from emerging as well. So this was to be achieved by providing for the interest of advanced industrial nations to, again, this is a quote, "we must maintain the mechanisms for deterring potential competitors from even aspiring to a larger regional or global role." So the US had to control key regions, key energy corridors, and make sure that no rivals would possibly emerge. Even Germany, Japan, and other allies were listed as possible rivals. Again, there could be no challenge to US dominance. Obviously, this also puts strict limitations on any role that Russia could play in Europe, and any integration between the Russians and other leading European powers, such as Germany. Now, the leading intellectual work on US control for Eurasia after the Cold War was written by Zbigniew Brzezinski, an advisor to many presidents, such as Jimmy Carter and Barack Obama, and who also had a central role in arming the Mujahideen in Afghanistan during the 1980s. So Brzezinski, he noted that hegemony and control over Eurasia depended on America's ability to keep powers divided, maintain security dependence on the US, and this will be the recipe for controlling or the perpetual dominance of Eurasia from the maritime periphery. And this is why the maritime hegemon, now the United States, relies on alliance systems. as the world is then divided into blocks. On one side, you have dependent vassals who will do as they're told, and on the other side, you have contained adversaries. And this would then prevent serious peace from breaking out, which would then end these dividing lines. Brzezinski also argued that Russia was weak and it had no other options than to lean towards the West. And for this reason, Russia would become a geostrategic black hole at the dual periphery of Europe and East Asia. And this was what the United States should aim to exploit. In the words of Brzezinski, and this is a quote, it created the preconditions for the progressive geopolitical expansion of the Western community deeper and deeper into Eurasia, end quote. So if Russia would resist the Western penetration into Eurasia, then, quote, Russia must know that there would be a massive blockade of Russia's maritime access to the West, end quote. The idea that is that Russia itself should ideally also be divided and be organized into what Brzezinski referred to as a loosely confederated Russia, composed of a European Russia, a Siberian Republic, and an Eastern, Far Eastern Republic. Now, while Russia was to be severed from Europe and ideally split into separate regions or countries, the US was developing its own Silk Road initiatives. But this is a very different Silk Road. It was not a decentralized multipolar format with diversified connectivity. Instead, it had the purpose of dividing Eurasia to maintain its own hegemon. So we saw that all initiatives, be it TAPI pipeline from Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India, or the Georgian Azerbaijani pipeline to access Central Asia, it all had an explicit purpose of severing Central Asia from Russia ch and China. Again, this was a hegemonic vision of Eurasia. Now, around 2014, two things happened that began to change the world order. And the first was that in 2014, NATO countries toppled the government in Ukraine, which signaled to the Russians that any hope of greater Europe was dead, as Ukraine would be a front line instead of a bridge. Indeed, as we learned later, even on the first day after the coup, the Americans already began to cooperate with the new intelligence services in Ukraine, which the American had installed, to rebuild them from scratch in order to use who were previously the main partner of Russia as America's main partner to target Russia in a covert war. So this was the first thing to happen, the coup in Ukraine. The second thing that happened around this time was that China had lost its faith in the durability of the US-led international economic system, and it had developed enough power to begin to challenge it. And this is exactly what China began to do. It began to challenge the US-led international economic system. In 2013, we saw the launch of the Belt and Road Initiative, that is, the efforts to revive the old Silk Road, which dominated prior to the rise of the Western maritime powers. We also saw the emergence of very ambitious technological and industrial policies in 2015, such as the Tw China 2025 program, which had the objective to establish Chinese leadership in all the main technologies associated with the Fourth Industrial Revolution. And we also saw new financial instruments emerging, new banks. In 2015, with the foundation of the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, and also the Chinese currencies would begin to be internationalized, but also use the currencies of other countries. Now, with both Russia and China losing the faith in the US-led economic system, we saw now a format for greater Eurasia emerging. Indeed, Russia abandoned the dream of a common Europe and embraced the Greater Eurasian Initiative instead. So no longer would Russia look to the West for development, as it had done since Peter the Great 300 years earlier. And with China as its main partner, it could now look to the East instead for this development and economic cooperation. And for the West, its efforts to split Russia from Europe and Germany, it was pushed towards China into Asia. Now, in the 19th century, this would have made Russia more economically backwards, perhaps. But in the more modern era, this would be Mackinder's worst nightmare. The two massive Eurasian powers, Russia and China, connected for the objective of undermining the dominance from the maritime periphery. And we see that China's Belt and Road Initiative reconnects the Eurasian continent both by land and sea with railroads, highways, seaports, digital networks. And with this physical connectivity, there's a growing trade, integration of supply chains, tech partnerships, industrial cooperation, financial cooperation with new banks, and the use of national currencies. And essentially, we see the foundations for a new international economic architecture. And this is not simply a cooperation between Russia and China. Indeed, it connects the entire continent and beyond this, also the world. And it's an incredibly popular idea because Eurasia represents multipolarity. That means not all decisions will be dictated from one center of power. And Greater Eurasia also makes a lot of sense for Russia, which can transition from this dual periphery of Europe and East Asia and instead position itself at the center of a much larger construct. So Russia's Western-centric energy export infrastructure has gradually been redirected to the East instead, primarily China, but also India. Now in the West, we see the economies became stagnant, and there's been a seemingly enduring hatred of Russia over the centuries. While in the East, the economies are more dynamic, and Russia has largely been welcomed. So Russia therefore has its own projects. It of course has this East-West corridor along the Trans-Siberian Railroad, but we also see that the Russians are developing the Northern Sea Route along the Arctic, which is the roof of the Eurasian continent, which offers a fast and cheap transportation corridor, which is also outside the control of the US Navy, although NATO is increasingly planning to enter the Arctic seemingly in a big way. Well, we also see that the Russians are building their international north-south transportation corridor, a corridor connecting Russia with Iran and India, which is a much faster and cheaper corridor than the alternative Suez Canal. Now, also this is something that connects the neighboring countries close to Russia, Iran, and India. Now, it's an important part of Iran's efforts, therefore, to connect with Eurasia, and it now sees the partnership with China and Russia to be of the greatest importance. And for India, it's also important. It is interested in Eurasian integration. However, it doesn't want it to become too China-centric. China, also recognizing that Eurasian integration will be welcomed if it's multipolar, does not oppose any of the diversification, for example, by India and Russia connecting further. So from South Korea to China, India, Kazakhstan, Russia, Iran, the Arab states, they all have strategies for Eurasian integration. These initiatives are different, but they all have in common that they require improving relations with each other and finding political solutions to the disputes to connect, because no one power on the Eurasian continent can impose its initiative on others. It's therefore a need to harmonize interests instead. So, for example, Russia and China have very different initiatives and preferences in Central Asia. Yet we also see that neither can achieve what they want without harmonizing interests with the other side. This is why we see that the Western assumptions that the Russians and Chinese would clash over Central Asia never played out as expected. And the reason is because neither are now competing for hegemony. Instead, they're looking for a multipolar system. For this reason, we see that the Russian Eurasian Economic Union and China's Belt and Road Initiative became harmonized under the format of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. And the leading organization to connect a new international economic system is obviously BRICS. And these are no longer just ports, roads, or railroads, but we also now have digital corridors, energy corridors, grain corridors, and various tech partnerships. We have industrial integration, trade in national currencies, common development banks, payment systems, and commodity exchanges. So the alternative to the Eurasian multipolar system is for everyone to submit themselves under the maritime hegemon, seeking to split Central Asia from China, split China from Russia, Russia from India, split India from Iran, split Iran from Turkey, etc. So it is an empire of chaos in this sense, reliant on alliance systems and perpetual conflicts. So irrespective of seeing benefit or disadvantage in the continuation of US global primacy, it doesn't really matter that much, really, because it's simply not sustainable, and it is declining. And when a hegemon becomes weakened, it also becomes more aggressive. That is, while it previously would try to build trust around its administrative control of an international economy, we instead see that a declining hegemon is more likely to use its control coercively to prevent rivals from emerging, which is why the Americans have started a tech economic war against the Chinese, an energy and proxy war against Russia. We see the Europeans having joined in, now discussing the legalization of theft by stealing the Russian sovereign funds. And this is an effort to prevent the rise of rivals. However, it has the exact opposite effect. It only incentivizes the rest of the world to diversify their economic partnerships within this greater Eurasian context. So, the West's instinctive resistance to cooperation in Eurasia in order to preserve the dominance of the maritime powers, it neglects that this is no longer the 19th century or 20th century. First of all, Russia doesn't have the capabilities or the intentions to dominate Eurasia. And the threat coming from Eurasia is no longer of a competing hegemon. Rather, it's a multipolar system. So, in the past, when the US would have been happy to see a balance of power in Eurasia, the only reason this is no longer acceptable is because the US only accepts a hegemonic model. Now, there are an abundance of mistakes, therefore, being done by the West. For example, the theft of the sovereign funds from the Russian central banks has made the world fear the Western financial system and desperately seeking alternatives. The attack on Chinese tech threatens supply chains reliant on the West, and we therefore see the West being pushed out of the supply chains. And the fear of choke points in maritime corridors creates more demands for alternatives. So we can't really address these issues in the West because, in the tribal mindset we're currently stuck, anyone can be accused of siding with the adversary by pointing out the extent we're doing self-harm. And our narratives thus become ever more decoupled from reality. However, in Europe, there is much that can be gained from adjusting away from the hegemonic idea and accepting multipolar realities. That is a new international distribution of power, which has already developed. However, this is the main problem. There is absolutely no willingness to accept the huge changes occurring and to make the necessary adjustment to maximize economic prosperity and also security. Instead, to quote Machiavelli, men will not look at things as they really are, but as they wish them to be, and they are ruined. So, what are the sentiments in Russia today? I believe they can be summarized by a quote from Dostoevsky. And the quote is, "Russians are as much Asiatics as Europeans. The mistake of our policy for the past two centuries has been to make the people of Europe believe that we are true Europeans. We have bowed ourselves like slaves before the Europeans, and we have only gained their hatred and contempt. It is time to turn away from ungrateful Europe. Our future is in Asia." And my point here is simply this, that the geography matters, like it always has, and the world has entered a very important inflection point. And this is why a Eurasian world order is now in the making. And all the efforts to prevent this is only intensifying its development even further.